You are listening to the San Antonio Zen Center Dharma Talks. The San Antonio Zen Center is supported solely by donation, so that everyone can participate in our offerings and programs, regardless of income. If you are able, please consider making a donation to SAZC through the donation button on our site, sanantoniozen.org, or by visiting paypal.me/sanantoniozen. Thank you for your practice and enjoy the talk. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome, Makaira. Good morning, Sanko and Marta. Good to see you both. So there's a movement afoot. Has been afoot for a while, which is a mindfulness movement. And it seems as though corporations have found this out. They bring people in to teach mindfulness at work. Some folks refer to it as like mindfulness ink. Really the main difference in this practitioner's limited view between this corporate mindfulness and what we practice in Buddhist temples is there's often an ethical element that's missing. It's a crucial distinction, this ethical element. The moral element. And these can be loaded words, ethical and moral, because for some folks, an image may arise of shaking fingers, shaming. And that's not what's meant by the ethical or moral. It's about how we take care of each other. The Bodhisattva path. How we take care of ourselves. And with this moral undertaking, if we take the Bodhisattva precepts, we are saying, I'm gonna take this on. I'm gonna vow to try and do good and not harm self or others. And one does not have to be a theist to be moral. Being non-theistic, which Buddhism is,
being not theistic doesn't mean that you can't be moral, you can't be ethical. Just as being theistic doesn't mean that you are moral. So with the ethics, part of which is right action. Right action is part of the section of the Noble Eightfold Path that deals with the ethics, along with right conduct, for example. And so right action, we can say conducive action, action that is conducive to the awakening of self and others. It's conducive for well-being. The Noble Eightfold Path is our actions that are conducive for the well-being of self and others. And also we can see right action is right conduct as well too. Just remember how we engage with this phenomenal world, how we physically interact with everything around us. It means we have to take the time to slow down and to really pay attention to what we're doing. As in the title of one of the books about the precepts, waking up to what we do. Right action, which is also called sammakkhamata, broken down into three actions for us. It's not killing, not stealing, and not engaging in sexual misconduct. And if we notice these three things, not killing, not stealing, not engaging in sexual misconduct, are part of the original five precepts. So these go way, way, way back for us. Along with them, along with not lying, dharma to lie, and dharma to use intoxicants. So those three things make up the original five precepts. So not killing is right action. Seems pretty straightforward. The nuance of that is not threatening the welfare of others, either physically or verbally. Or even, I think, in our monkey mind. Yeah, I think we're familiar with some resentments that come up. We've all been in the throes of this. In the Lankavatara Sutra, talks about this resentments as being infatuations. Isn't that interesting, right? Because there is that element of intoxication whenever we really, when we really hold a grade A grudge. We automatically place ourselves in a superior position and they become less than. So that's killing. That's killing. Even if it's implied in some way. Oh, so we have to slow down. What am I doing here? What am I doing? When we threaten someone, we've already harmed them, right? We really pay attention. That relationship has already been harmed. It's really hard to undo that. And Shanti Deva tells us this, and he says, you can do all these good things, and all it takes is a moment of anger to wipe it all away. Sticks and stones may break our bones, and words can kill us. Anytime we dehumanize someone, we've delifed them, depersoned them, made them less than, made them into a thing. No. Made them into a thing. And this bears so much care. This bears so much care. I have worked with veterans who are carrying the burden of having killed. It's one of the most traumatic things that can happen for people in combat. Is having killed someone, and they get up close and they see this guy's just like me, and there's a wound that comes about as a result of that, and it's the same thing for torturers, people whose job it is to extract information. They become dehumanized. And also apparently the burnout with death row guards with ex in the execution is very high. They are traumatized by having participated in killing. And related to this is that not killing also means not encouraging others to take life. One psychologist I knew talked about there's a phenomenon in a group with people that's called "Let's You and Him Fight," where someone provokes chaos between the company folks. That's encouraging that harmony. And it takes quite a lot for us to say no. To say no, even in the presence of authority figures. This is one of the ways that killing happens, is the presence of an authority figure. There's a famous study that you may be aware of, where an experiment, not a study, where a guy sat down at a box and he had to ask questions to somebody he couldn't see who's on the other side of the wall. And anytime the answer was incorrect, he had to throw a switch that would administer an electrical shock. And there was a one of the people leading the study was standing there in a lab coat. And with each wrong answer, he had to ramp up the shock. And so he did it. Guy screaming on the other side of the wall, pleading for him to stop. And the authority figure says, "Go ahead. Next question." And the poor guy, who the study is all about, is clearly distraught. The presence of the authority figure compels him to keep going. I don't think they ever knew what happened to him afterwards. So this is really important. So the reason I bring this up is that it's important to take stock of our surroundings, wherever we are. Be willing to say, "No, I will not." Which is really hard if there is a very strong authority. Thankfully, we don't do that. But it's just the same thing with the Dalai Lama went to Auschwitz, I believe it was. Telling me, he cried all the way through the camps. And then afterwards, he said, "I vow never to participate or allow something like this to happen." And you think, this guy's so good. Why does he need to do this? Wouldn't he just automatically do it? No, we need to take that vow. We need to take that vow. We need to say it out loud in the presence of others. "I don't have to do this. Please help me." We cannot do this alone. So even if the authority figure is there, we can say, "I need some help with this guy." So abstaining from theft. Not stealing, not taking what is not offered. There five different classic ways that we can steal. One is secretly, so pickpocketing or embezzling. By force, or by threat of force, by deception, by a false claim, and by coercion. We can steal someone's time too, by demanding their time. By dominating their time, by not making someone else's time available to others. It's good to look at all of these and see what are the, and to be honest, like the 12 step thing is a searching into fearless moral inventory. What are the ways that I've stolen like this in the past? Can I forgive myself for it and move on? And not give in to these temptations in the future, or make a vow in front of others, not to do it. Anytime you take the precepts, you're saying, yeah, I vow in the presence of others not to do this. And finally, the last right action is sexual misconduct. In the ways that this shows up for us is by someone who cannot give their consent due to a variety of reasons. So it's considered that someone in a relationship who's already in a relationship cannot consent because they've already committed to this other person. A minor, obviously, or someone who's in the care of another. So, like if they're like an illness or like an institutional setting. One that's very important that we've seen a lot of over the past number of years is someone who is incapacitated by drugs or alcohol. Someone who's in jail or in prison. And here's a really important one is someone who's in a position of disparate power. So like a doctor and a patient, or a lawyer and a client, student and teacher, right? Anyone who wears these robes has to be very, very aware, very mindful of all this. In a practice like ours, it can be difficult to discern, right? Because we may be we've been practicing here at the Zen Center for 6 months. You think I'm a newbie? I don't have any power. Somebody who's brand new comes in, and what's the word that we're a little shiny, you know? So people think we know something, you know, or have some kind of power. It's not just student teacher. It's a senior student or someone someone who has power but can't see that they have power. So it's really important. It's really, really important. If we think, oh, I've only been coming 6 months, I'm not that powerful. Well, to this person we are. It's taken lots of care. Lots of care. And the longer we practice, the more careful we have to be. And all of these, everything I've said, should be an encouragement, right? It's not a thou shalt not. This is like, how can I take care of? How can I take care of the soft wounds? And these are ways, they're kind of laying out, okay, these are where some of the landmines are. So we need to stay away from this, right? So that we can take care of folks. So this right action can be an action of purification by refraining from actions that we may have done in the past. As a form of liberation. And it also brings us in tune with our vow to save all beings. when this vow, when this intention of this vow to awaken begins to awaken. That's when we really, really start practicing. You know, this is when we start to show up. We have the opportunity to really start showing up.